Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to an August 8th, 2007 segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. Tonight's guest is Brad Dennis, who may be an unknown name to you. However, Mr. Dennis has actually been at alternative energy research for about 30-some years, researching various auto fuel efficient technologies as well as auto engine designs that are far from common knowledge. He is a mechanical engineering and corporate finance degreed individual. And Mr. Dennis, you're with us, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Very happy to have you with us. I suppose we should begin with the typical question that I ask my guests, and that is, when did you first become interested in alternative energy technology, or the technology of squeezing more miles out of a gallon of fuel?
Well, I can put it down to almost a month.
Really?
May of 1977.
Okay.
There was a national news article. At that time, we were running into rising gasoline prices. There had been a national news article about Tom Ogle, O-G-L-E, out of El Paso, Texas, young man that had achieved what seemed to surpass what the auto industry could produce, a 5,000-pound car with 102 miles per gallon. That article intrigued me, since I had an engineering and hands-on experience with IC engines or internal combustion engines for quite some time. intrigued me to the point where I started to research what he had produced, and research it to the point where I've actually met the people that purchased the worldwide marketing rights of his patent portfolio.
Okay, now Tom Ogle was not a what we would call a degreed mechanical engineer, or
no, he was not.
He was more or less a country boy, right?
He was a pretty much a country boy, hands-on mechanic. Had just mechanical skills and an understanding that something was wrong with the vehicles that he was working on and repairing when we were seeing fuel prices run from in the upper 20, low 30 cents a gallon to a dollar and a quarter in a very short period of time. There became an interest in increasing the fuel efficiency of our large V8 automobiles of the period. He did some research and came across a historical, well-known name, Charles Nelson Pogue.
Oh, so he was aware of Pogue's work.
Oh, he literally copied it.
Very interesting. Now, I was under the impression that he sort of stumbled on this technology by realizing that dripping gasoline on a hot exhaust pipe or muffler on the lawnmower caused the, I suppose he must have deliberately done this because the
No,
the
originally he used a gas can, just a gas can with a few drops of fuel in it, and created a seal and a tube over to the intake manifold of the lawnmower and began to run the lawnmower with just a few ounces of fuel within the gas can as it sat in the sun.
Oh, interesting.
Not
so there's where he got
the hardest thing to do, but what the radiant sunlight was doing to the gas was increasing its vaporization rate, and he was running the little lawnmower engine on dry gas vapor. The intention of the internal combustion engine is really to run on dry gas vapors.
Okay, and maybe we can get into some of that history, because earlier today we had a brief conversation. It was the first time we'd ever talked, and it was really fascinating, the things that we covered, and hopefully we'll be able to cover all those things and more during this hour. you had mentioned that in the history of the internal combustion engine, and we're going back now to the latter half of the 19th century, right?
Correct.
There were other internal combustion engines prior to that, but that's when...
The names that stick in most minds today and when they're going through their history of the internal combustion engine or the automobile engine would be Dr. Otto of the Otto spark-ignited cycle, four-cycle, and then Rudolf Diesel with the diesel cycle, which is a compression ignition cycle. The interesting parts were back then, here's where the air was made. We were presently utilizing steam crank lever rotating mechanisms for our propulsion. And what took place was there's an abundant supply of petroleum chemicals, and we were trying to eliminate a hybriding system we had then. The hybriding system was utilizing wood or coal to heat a working fluid, water at the time, water to steam. Steam would then create the pressure to push a piston, and a crank lever rotating motion could be created for work. What took place was this abundant supply of petroleum and the wants and desires to grow the petroleum business. Inventors looked at trying to utilize those chemicals in a cylinder simply, and they did. The problem that has evolved from that point was we went down the road of a piece of machinery that was designed to run from steam propulsion and was never designed to work on all of the idiosyncrasy characteristics of hydrocarbons or gasoline and diesel fuels today. Yet we have built our entire global industries off of that crank lever steam concept, steam design, and we are burning hydrocarbons in cylinders that physically and chemically cannot be utilized efficiently with a crankshaft, with a crankshaft and a rod design that we have today. It does not utilize enough time to burn the fuels efficiently.
Very interesting. Well, an Italian physicist by the name of Ruggero Santilli, I don't know if you ever heard of him, he's responsible for the Magna Gas technology. That's his contention, that you cannot completely burn these carbon molecules, these tightly bound carbon molecules in...
No, it's a time and physics relationship. And here's what's so interesting. As the industry grew to the point where the automobile was starting to become a dominant factor of consumption of oil products, and that particular product, gasoline, then the chemistry and the science was understood in the 1920s to slow the process down even further, not building the machinery to utilize the chemistry and energy content that's in the fuel, but camouflage the fuel further to the point that the consumption curve could be controlled, and it's controlled by the volume of automobiles or engines that were being built, so then they could determine how much oil to produce, and we had the machinery that was inefficient by design, and we continually make those engines today as inefficient as they were at the turn of the century.
Boy, you know, to me that just, it spells evil, you know?
Oh, it's absolute evil.
It is evil when a natural resource on this planet gets used up faster than it should, with the resulting pollution because of someone greedily saying, let's make it less efficient so that we make more money.
Well, we must go back in time and think about environment and natural resources were not the consideration of the day.
Well, we say that.
Profit.
You know something? If you go back and find some very old books on nature, you know, biology and so on, you'll find that there were intelligent people many decades ago who were saying, we've got to stop what we're doing to the forest, to the ocean, to the atmosphere. You know, there were perceptive people who understood this decades ago.
Oh, absolutely. But it never became a green theme like it is today. It never became in the thoughts of the masses that we need to now look at what we're doing, because we're seeing those effects daily with rising temperature rates, melting ice areas of the planet, and we're seeing some of these effects of human interaction and the abusing of our resources.
Yeah, well, Jean Manning, I don't know if you're familiar with her, an author, wrote a book on the coming energy revolution. She was a guest on this program a few weeks ago, and she commented that apparently we needed to have our noses rubbed in it, because when her book came out 11 years ago, people didn't pay much attention then. Now they're a little more inclined to, but it's like we have to be at death's door before we wake up and say, you know what, maybe we better start being concerned about what we're doing to this planet.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think what probably got my concern from when you first asked the question, how did I get so entrenched into this study? I had first seen this news article of this young man down in Texas, became so entrenched in it, I built one of the devices, simulated very close to what results he had come up with, and contacted the company that purchased those rights in Seattle, Washington, flew out there on their cost, they flew me out there to take a look at what they had discovered and purchased, because I had some personal knowledge of one of the historically known inventors of this type of technology, Charles Nelson Pogue. I had met Mr. Pogue in January of 1980. At that time, I was writing some engineering engine technology columns for a paper in Canada, and we were doing a more in-depth study on Mr. Pogue's carburetors of the 1930s. And I had met an individual that could get me to him, and we went over and visited him one afternoon. That was probably one of the most interesting afternoons I had ever spent with, even in today's world, when you research through the Internet. Charles Nelson Pogue is the Edison of the fuel vaporization carburation systems for cars when it comes to high mileage.
Now, what exactly was it that motivated Pogue? How did he get interested in this technology? Did you ever find that out?
It was just a study of looking at the explosive nature of gasoline back then. His real work and effort in this was just an admiration for internal combustion engines, and that they were running too hot and they were seemingly burning too many fuels. And he just became entrenched in this idea that there was something wrong with the application of the chemistry and the mechanical device.
And how did he finance his research?
There was an investor, W.J. Holmes, who owned a skating rink up there, if I recall, in Winnipeg. And he bankrolled Mr. Pogue during the Depression period, from the late 20s through the 30s, about 1936. And he spent $100,000 of capital to finance this lone inventor on this project. And those dollars in that period was a tremendous amount of money.
Yes, I'd say so.
Yeah, and so they developed, there were four different Pogue carburetors. Three of them were high mileage that worked on a catalytic theme of taking simple distilled skim gasoline and running it through some catalytic metal reactive beds to, in essence, crack the fuel on board from a liquid to a total methane tape molecule chain gas state. And in doing so, now you can mix two like chemicals, the atmosphere and this hydrocarbon gas, dry gas vapor, in a short millisecond time frame, is the short frame for burning fuels. And you could do it homogeneously. You could get a fine stoichiometric as defined by definition, not in practicality. And let's get back to that in a minute. But you could get a perfect burn out of these two like gases. So he found out that he developed these different concepts, the different patents. When you study the patent microfilm libraries, you'll find Mr. Pogue's patents from the late 1920s through the early 30s. And he had the last one, which was the one that they made the public display of, or I made a public announcement of, in the Winnipeg Tribune, if I recall, on January 22nd, 1936. And here's a photo of Mr. Pogue in a 1930 1986 Ford two-door coupe, and W.J. Holmes, his financier. They had produced 216.8 miles per gallon. That's an imperial gallon. That's roughly 170-plus miles per gallon using a U.S. gallon measurement.
Now, I understand that the engines from that era, from that time, 1934 or so, backwards, really were a different animal than the engines we drive now in terms of the length of the connecting rods, the RPMs that they ran at, and so on.
Oh, they were longer.
So they weren't such high compression engines as we have
now.
They
weren't high compression, but what they were was the longer connecting rods, longer stroke, allowed for more time at top dead center so that there was more time to burn the fuel. They were better at burning fuel then.
So we actually moved away from a more fuel-efficient engine and a less polluting engine, huh?
We are purposefully, by design, building engines for consumption.
Yeah. And would someone say that we're paranoid in saying that this is actually a conspiracy?
No, this isn't paranoid. This is easily provable now.
In other words, people say, well, what we really wanted was more speed because the roads in the U.S. and in the rest of the world improved. It was possible to go faster. People wanted more power. They didn't want to drive an old, Tin Lizzie-type, slow-moving, weak vehicle. They wanted a sporty, fast-accelerating, and so on. And so,
well, let's go over something that's kind of interesting. There was a maintained chemical to horsepower ratio over 1950s, 60s, 70s, and part of the 80s. And this is a relationship I stumbled across. Was looking at the what's called the horsepower per cubic inch. And so we would take a look at if chemical energy goes into a mechanical device, an engine, to produce so much horsepower or work, then you would take the size of the motor and how much horsepower or work I could get out of it. So that would give me a relationship between how efficient the chemistry was moving through it. We maintained roughly around, at the high performance side, during the 50s and 60s and early 70s, roughly one horse per cube. We maintained it for 2.5 to 3 decades. By maintaining that type of engineering within the manufacturing process, and we know how many vehicles are manufactured and are on the road, we can roughly determine the amount of oil to produce or gasoline to produce and control an orderly market pricing.
Very interesting.
I perceive that what we've got here is from back in the 1850s, we used what machinery was available at that time to try and burn these fuels in a cylinder, which was a nice adaptation and a low cost since our industry was all built off of the steam propulsion. We then switch over, and lo and behold, the automobile becomes this incredibly demanded device, and gasoline, which had been a waste byproduct, becomes the highest volume turned over product within our economic cycle. We take that and extrapolate forward during the 20s, 30s, and 40s. We now see how important selling gasoline becomes in this country from the dollar multiplier to the federal tax revenue, state tax revenue for the highway programs. As we move forward, we want to sell new products. They need to have more zip and zing to them, so to speak, so they become more powerful, or that's what they advertise. But the horsepower per cube stays the same for decades. The motor displacements become bigger. The consumption of gasoline keeps increasing. And now the U.S., as of about 15 minutes ago, I looked on the Internet, we consume presently, right now, 20,480,000 gallons or barrels of crude in a given 24-hour period.
Gallons or barrels?
Barrels.
20 million barrels?
20.5 million barrels in one 24-hour period.
Yeah, isn't that insane?
Now, just do some simple math. Let's just round off and say there's 20 million barrels. And the amount of gasoline produced out of a 42-gallon barrel of oil, let's just make it 40 gallons. Gasoline is about half of that product. So we can take 20 times 40s, 800 million gallons times half, 400 million gallons consumed of gasoline product in one day. At $3 a gallon, that's $1.2 billion in 24 hours.
Wow.
Believe me, the automobile engine is the consumption maintenance control device for the consumption of oil and gasoline product.
Yeah. Well, you know, all of us make a living selling something that we hope the consumer will use up and need our good or our service again, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm the first to admit that in my business, I hope that people wear out their floors because that's what I do for a living. I resurface floors, you know. So all of us hope that some kind of obsolescence will take place so that we can continue to make a living. It seems that that's what most of us are engaged in, you know, maintaining a supply or a service for something that wears out or gets used up or whatever. So a certain amount of that, we have to say, is part of our, you know, survival in the economy that we all live in. But there's something much more sinister about this, as you say, the volume of something and something that's so harmful to the biosphere.
Well, now, I would be more acceptable if we had allowed the engines to develop with our knowledge over the decades. And what I mean by that is, earlier today we spoke about one particular fuel system design that was designed by an oil company. In the late 1930s and early 1940s, Texaco developed a system called the Texaco Controlled Combustion Process. And it allowed for a change of a cylinder head on an automobile engine and thus allowed that engine instantaneously to double its fuel mileage under same driving conditions and be multi-fueled.
So using the same piston and crank...
Nothing else was changed, the cylinder head. And
but changing the shape or the valve timing?
Really what it was disposing of a carburetor, which is nothing more than an aerosol spray can of fuel. You're disposing of this poor, inefficient design because it sprays liquid droplets, and liquid droplet fuel does not burn. It
right.
ends up on the exhaust side and out the exhaust as emissions.
But you're here to tell people that a improved... not an inversion, but a replacement of the carburetor, existed now for
over
70
years,
and the world did not pay attention because it wasn't given the publicity, and gasoline was cheap back then, probably also contributed to people
gasoline
not being interested.
Gasoline was cheap. This system was brought up by an oil company who was more knowledgeable about chemistry of the hydrocarbons and detonation and application to engines of the period. And they came forward and said, we could put this out here. They showed what was coming in the future. Well, here's what they did. They showed it in the 50s. They showed it in the 60s. And finally, when we have some shortages of the early 1970s and the late 70s, now all of a sudden a demand or interest for more fuel efficiency surfaces. There's more articles about Texaco's system in the late 70s, and yet it never, to this day, has made it to the marketplace. We're getting closer with a new system that we're presently using in the expensive cars called direct injection. But the way the Texaco controlled combustion process works is you put a fuel injection nozzle directly integrated with the igniter or the spark to light the fuel, and you do not compress fuel in the compression stroke. It is the compression stroke takes place with atmospheric air only at the proper ignition point. Fuel sprays out and is ignited so that what is maintained here is what's called a stationary flame front. Now fuel does not have to be refined to have an octane value. It can be simple distilled, undistilled and unrefined distillates, or it can be kerosene, jet fuel, diesel or gasoline. The motor will run on any one of those fuels with this type of fuel system.
Very interesting. Now, let's go back to...
I think one more point on before we jump away from that. What's upsetting is they knew how to do this 50 years ago, and it is not allowed into the marketplace today. So we've had 50 years where the consumer has paid at least twice what he should have for his transportation costs.
Yeah.
That's what's upsetting.
And then the amount of pollution that's resulted as well.
Exactly.
And you could even say the amount of deaths from fiery crashes and whatnot, because if a vehicle gets 200 miles per gallon or thereabouts, you don't need to carry but 2 gallons of fuel on board to have the kind of range that the average vehicle is looking for these days, or has
sure.
always been looking for.
It's my contention that what we will see in this library of automotive fuel-efficient technologies that I have collected over 30 years, slowly I am seeing these technologies come forward as fuel goes up per gallon cost and is amortized into the cost of the vehicle. What you will see is it used to be at $1 a gallon, 15 miles to the gallon. At 2, you might get close to 20, 22, 25 miles a gallon. My contention is at near $5 a gallon, you'll get your 50 miles per gallon. Same, and what will be important when, from a historical standpoint, when someone goes back to check, you will still see a 3,500-pound car get 50 miles per gallon, and to go back 20 years when fuel was considerably cheaper, that 3,500-pound car will get 15 miles to the gallon. What did we note? Well, the energy content was there all along, but we didn't apply it until the cost of the gallon became such a spread between the cost of producing the oil and what we could sell it for. We make more profit, less volume, but we just mark it up higher.
Yeah, and that's what it's all about. Just like they're selling diluted antifreeze now for the same price they sold the concentrate.
Isn't that the funniest thing?
Yeah, and the younger generation doesn't realize that you used to buy a concentrate of this stuff for a couple dollars.
They don't see it. They accept it as part of the cost of doing business or living. I buy a gallon. It's already pre-diluted, so all I have to do is pour it in there. And they just don't get it that it's you have just been taken because they have diluted the gallon by 50%, and they're literally charging you a dollar less a gallon.
Yeah. Now, let's go back. You mentioned 50 years ago. There's something else that happened 50 years ago with regard to mixing water with fuel. Is that correct?
Sure. There was an inventor who brought forth, tried to push an agenda, and that was Rudy Gunnerman. And he brought forth a technology of water fuel. And as most high school chemistry would ever come across, you know that you cannot mix a hydrocarbon and water. They separate. The water is heavier in specific gravity, and it'll go to the bottom, and the hydrocarbons will go to the top, and they won't mix together, even though both have the ability to be fuels in their chemical makeup. You can't get the two of them to stay together. Well, he came up with a method to do so. It's a very simple process of using an alcohol, you can use an ethanol or a methanol, any types of alcohol, but those are the two most prominently known today. And you can use a gasoline or a diesel and a surfactant and water. And if you mix them in the proper proportions, and in the proper assembly order, they mix together and they create a white, milky-looking substance. It doesn't hardly smell. It has a small residual smell of fuel, but not as pungent as straight gasoline or straight diesel. And you can pour it right in the engine and run it.
And now, this is what came to be known as A55?
A55, which stands for aqueous fuels, 55% water by weight. And it also had another trademark terminology. A21 stood for aqueous fuels for the 21st century.
Now, have you ever actually seen that product work?
Yep, I have a video of it.
So, some of the when you do a word search on the internet, there is someone claiming that this guy was a fraud, a scam, whatever.
No, I've got a video of at that time, the one individual I knew had purchased the worldwide aviation fuel rights for Gunnerman's fuel. And he had demonstration purposes, he would set up an aviation light homing on an engine stand and go through the entire process, how it worked. The secret was in the surfactant. And it's quite interesting how the surfactant works. It's not too far from a derivative of borax. Soap. If you wash your hands with oily residual from working on the car and you use a borax or a strong detergent, it breaks down the hydrocarbons on your hands. Well, this is nothing more than a soap-type mixture that allows the water and the hydrocarbons to mix and stay together. Now, if the oil industry can mix ethanol and gasoline together at greater than 10%, which they normally would separate, they're using surfactants to hold it together. So E85 today has surfactants in it to hold it together. Same surfactants that would be in Gunderman's aqueous fuels. So they know how to make the fuels. We could use these fuels to double the fuel source availability for every airline globally and cut down on that demand as far as the amount of barrels we use per day. We could burn it in our cars. We could burn it in our lawnmowers. It would be cleaner because an aqueous fuel will burn far cleaner than a straight hydrocarbon fuel.
And why is that?
Well,
we talked about detonation time or top dead center time. Why would the water being present with the hydrocarbon fuel cause that combustion to be more complete?
Go back to the original part of our discussion. The engines are built incorrectly. They're built off of bad timing. We overfeed them fuel by design. By diluting the mixture with water, we're creating part combustion engine, steam engine. And then the water starts to absorb some of the heat that the hydrocarbon fuel is creating. It reduces the nitrous oxides, and it's just a cleaner burn. You're creating part hydrocarbon burn, part steam expansion cycle. The engine will burn cleaner and cooler.
Okay, so water injection is basically accomplishing that also.
Sure.
But in Gunnerman's case, he's mixing the water with the fuel and feeding it together.
Exactly.
And using all the same equipment, the carburetor and everything?
What was so interesting is he had time in Washington, D.C. in subcommittee hearings to talk about this, to give a demonstration to show our congressmen and senators. Falls on deaf ears. They've known all about Gunderman's aqueous fuels. We're using it in certain parts of our commercial industries now. There's a ferry that runs back and forth in the San Francisco Bay that has been using aqueous fuels for, I think it's 4 to 5 years now.
Really?
And Senator Bob Dole was the one who spearheaded that program.
Interesting.
So
the government
on the radar screen, these technologies exist, but to the average person or public, for them to get this knowledge, so when it comes to voting time next year, I would think that these would be real important subjects to talk about, since we are now at $70+ a barrel and spending enormous amounts for gasoline that could be spent on other products or services to keep our economy going.
Yeah. The average person isn't interested in becoming informed on this subject. There are, fortunately, a few people in every state that do take it upon themselves to try to become in the know about technology as it relates to their use of energy and so on. But, you know, 99 out of 100 people just aren't interested.
It only gets to their attention on a phrase I used to coin called the pain in the pocket theory. When the pain in the pocket was great enough, they would pay attention to this information.
Yeah, but the problem with that late response to something that really needs to be given attention before the pain, because it is actually having far-reaching detrimental effects on us, the problem with that is that the person, when they experience the pain that causes them to react, they're not necessarily in a position to do anything.
No, they aren't. It's affecting the poor. It's pretty much it's hitting the lower socioeconomic level of our country by moving price up too quickly to their affordable index, affordability index.
Oh, it's impoverished people.
It has.
You know, there's more foreclosures going on in this country right now than ever.
Oh, and the amount of foreclosures is just going to mushroom if we do not come up with some type of safety valves to allow these people to either extend out those obligations or reduce those obligations. They can't afford to pay it. They went into overpriced real estate, or in the other side of the equation is a devalued dollar caused those prices of real estate to go up. And we've lost so much value, true purchase power value to the dollar in the past 5 years than the public really perceives. And that's
yeah.
what really caused the prices of the homes went up. And then we gave them subsidized financing so that we allowed them to buy these overpriced homes, which looked at affordable rates, except when you read the small print, and then they go to the readjust periods. And once they're readjusted, these are moving sometimes 50, 75, 100 basis points in a given year.
Yeah, and see, I wasn't even talking about people's ability to respond financially. Like, for instance, if you were to offer the Pogue carburetor in 1934 to the average person, they would weigh the cost of a gallon of gasoline at that time with the cost of the Pogue carburetor, which would have probably been, what, $100 or something at that time.
It would have been very expensive.
Yeah, and the average person made a dollar a day at that time, right? So it would have been cost prohibitive, and they would have gone on paying their 22 cents a gallon for gasoline or whatever it was back then, right?
Where this would have taken effect and done the most good would have been on an OEM basis.
Yeah, absolutely.
So from original equipment manufacturing.
But even then, the competition...
The cost to make it would have been pretty small once it's amortized over the production.
Yeah, but it all gets down to economics. And right now, what I was getting at was the average person is not in a position to respond technologically. If this is something that has to be implemented on a personal basis, because...
They've taken that away from them. Back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, where you could open the hood of your car and actually understand what was going on, and you could mechanically treat or change and adjust things under the hood. Today, it is locked down for a reason. They're going towards what's called the non-opening hood, closed hood type process of manufacturing.
Which reminds me of the rumor that when the Pogue carburetor was implemented during World War II on tanks in North Africa, it was covered with a that kind of black box lid.
Black
like
box. It
we
was
see
covered
on cars
up, sealed. It was not to be, no one was to work on it. They were not to have any knowledge of how it worked.
Yeah, and in fact, it is illegal to tamper with the fuel system of a car, basically, isn't it?
That there's an EPA regulation. It's a $10,000 fine per vehicle if you are in the business of modification of anything from OEM.
Yeah, so we're not very far different from the...
It's a lot of control.
Yeah, now, you had mentioned a lawsuit against the oil companies that retroactively suing them for all the lost money from the suppression of high-mileage carburetors. Is that something you think will ever happen?
Well, it's been my theory, and now I have the data to support a national class action lawsuit that would go back for 50 years and claim that we are due a repayment, the public is due a repayment for this oil overpricing and gouging of keeping fuel-efficient technology from the mass production and use of the average person.
And so we're looking for a lawyer who will pursue that class action.
I have met with three pretty prominent law firms and have been turned down three times. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, so maybe one of our listeners will be willing to step up to the plate.
Now, the dollar amounts involved here in the mathematical modeling I did on it seem to indicate somewhere between $5 to $7 trillion worth of refund is due.
So what attorney wouldn't want 50% of that?
I'm not sure.
Now, there's a Bork engine that we need to discuss in the remaining 20 minutes or so. What is the Bork engine? Where did it originate, and why is it appropriate for our needs today?
Well, what's so interesting is when we go back to where we started the conversation, and it's my thesis that we use steam engines, we modify them to burn fuels. We never designed the mechanical construct itself to burn the fuel correctly. We just modified the fuel to fit the design. Russell Bork in the late 30s used to teach combustion engineering and combustion classes. And he didn't like how the fuel was trying to be modified to fit the mechanical design, which didn't allow for enough timing to really use the fuel correctly. He built his own construct, his own two-cylinder opposed design that utilized something totally different than what we had been using. Instead of a crank lever mechanism, he used a crankshaft called a Scotch yoke. And what this really is a box, so to speak, with a bearing that runs inside of it. And what it allows for is a piston at during combustion to stay in a fixed space at top dead center for some 45 degrees of crank rotation. And what does this really do? This allows for the hydrocarbon fuel to be utilized. It first burns the carbon side of the fuel, and at 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit, there's enough heat to release and separate hydrogen from the carbon. So when you run a very lean air-fuel mixture with this design, you can now burn the hydrogen side of the fuel. And this is exactly how engines should be built, is to be able to burn not just the carbon and throw away the hydrogen, but use the carbon to start the ignition, the heat temperature rise, and then burn the hydrogen fuel. When that burns, it burns at 5,000 feet per second. It cleans the cylinder, and when the piston starts to go down, there is no emissions, and the cylinder is cooled by refrigeration effect. This motor runs without water cooling. It runs on multiple fuels, and it is twice the fuel efficiency of anything we make today.
So is there any excuse as to why we didn't begin using this engine back when it was devised?
Kind of interesting how the story goes. Russell Bork almost had a contract with the military shortly before World War II to sell these as utility engines for the military. And they just praised him about how unique and clever this idea was to go back and study the chemistry and find out how far off we were on using the fuels correctly. The war came across. After the war, he tried to resurrect that interest, and he was bad-mouthed by popular science magazines, hot rod magazines, etc., stating that he must be defying the laws of thermodynamics, he must be making wild, outrageous claims. They wouldn't look at the motor. It seemed as though somebody was blackballing him. It was very strange.
Now, you are of the mind that all of the institutions of higher learning that propagate this view toward efficient use of fuels and whatnot, that it is a violation of laws of physics, and that you can't beat stoichiometric as they define it, and so on. Earlier you expressed the feeling that...
After collecting this information and reviewing all of these inventions over time and their different applications of how to burn fuels far more efficient than we're presently using, it seems to be that our academic institutions in this country are teaching one line of thought, and hydrocarbon theory and chemical applications of hydrocarbons in IC engines are theories. I believe that they've gone down one road and they will not deviate from it. They will not look at other applications or more efficient uses of fuels. They keep training students that become combustion engineers and mechanical engineers, and a lot of their thinking is, I use a phrase that is called, they don't know, they don't know. And I believe that they go down just repeating what is in a series of books to these students, and that is all the knowledge they allow them to have. They will not look left or look right. They maintain their mind in a box.
So a previous guest referred to that as academic blinders.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, so what do you propose that should be done? I know you mentioned a movie, sort of a sequel to An Inconvenient Truth.
Well, what I'm trying to do is... If I saw Inconvenient Truth and it became quite aware for me that the public's got interest in this because they, in February of this year, gave him an Oscar for it. So the public seems to be finally interested in what's going on with our environment. But in Inconvenient Truth, which was a movie presentation of Al Gore's slide presentation of the information he's collected over time with his sources, is the tail end of the story. It doesn't get to the front end of the story. There's 300 million cars registered in the country of the U.S. that are burning fuels. Now, we're talking about new cars all the way to, you know, used old cars, but there's a lot of vehicles burning gasoline. And one of the primary sources that's producing this greenhouse gas effect, it's the automobile, the internal combustion engine globally. Let's go back and look at where we made the mistake, where we could have corrected, but industries, through their greed, decided to maintain the status quo. And here we are at a problem. Now we can match up what he was talking about, and we can see how we got to where we are.
And who knows where we would be if, as you said, the natural progression of improved technology had been allowed to take its course. Who knows where what we'd be using as a means of transportation right now?
Well, I know I see a lot of different technologies because I've got this interest in this subject matter. I've seen different electronic technologies that are large-scale capacitors, so to speak, that would be the electronic black box under the hood today for an electronic drive car. And you literally would plug this in, and it has a storage capacity like a battery, but much denser ability to hold the amount of energy to drive a car 200 or 300 miles electrically. And it has almost an instantaneous recharge. You plug it in, and within minutes, it's fully recharged to go again, much like when you stop to refill your tank in your car with fuels. That would be one technology that we could have evolved to. An example of what we could have done in the past 20 years, General Electric has had a 300% more efficient incandescent light bulb for a long time. It made one news release in the Wall Street Journal a while back, but what they ended up doing, they pushed the compact fluorescent light agenda, since incandescent bulbs sell for $2-3, and now we can sell one bulb for $3 or $4. It became, how do we monetize the technology to our best benefit?
And then that involves pollution also, because I understand the compact fluorescents are actually quite polluting as you dispose of them.
In the upcoming 10 to 20 years, when these bulbs have functional problems and they have to be disposed of and recycled, we've got a mercury issue, a huge mercury issue that's coming.
And they're not usable in all locations. They're not usable in a vibration-type environment like a ceiling fan or in other applications.
You can't use them in that. You can't use them in a place where you're trying to maintain a rheostat or a variability to them. You can't use them in real cold conditions.
So this is an example of the kind of stifling of good technology for the sake of greed.
If you changed the engines in the cars to double or triple their mileage and changed every light bulb in the country to a 300 more efficient, either through the design that General Electric has, which is nothing more than an incandescent bulb with between the two electrodes, they use a lattice work, much like the lattice work they use to make integrated circuits. So it creates a number of lines back and forth of very, very fine material that will carry and illuminate better than create resistance or heat. If we change those two technologies alone, we could drop probably 5 to 6 million barrels of crude a day.
That represents a lot of profit for someone.
Exactly.
And then there's the tax revenue. What would we do about the tax revenue that's lost from some of the energy technologies that would really result in no sales of fuel at all?
Right now, we're collecting federal and state tax revenue off this gallon, and just last week in the state of Minnesota, we had a major interstate bridge collapse. It was on national news. It just collapsed because it was outdated. It had serious corrosion issues that will be discovered. I went down and looked at it. I saw that it was a poor structure to start with, and it had serious corrosion issues, that those tax dollars collected from gallons sold should be pumped back into our infrastructure. Our roads and bridges are in terrible shape. Where's the money going? We don't know.
Well, it could be going to some black ops that suppress alternative energy.
It's possible.
No, so I'm joking, but...
My agenda would be to see if we can produce a film of some sort to get this information out, much like what happened to the electric car. That was a good film.
It was, and there needs to be one about internal combustion engines, you're saying.
Just do it on the internal combustion engine.
Yeah, and what an eye-opener it will be. And there's just so much out there, and they've done a masterful job of keeping it from the public's attention. But there are dirty tricks, a lot of shenanigans that have been played over the past 100 years.
Absolutely.
The
tricks, these technologies will come slow in small increments so that it creates the demand for the next year's product, but it's also built into the remonetization of the gallon to a higher level each time so that at $5 a gallon, you'll get 50 miles per gallon.
Well, they obviously haven't included the preservation of the American auto industry in their plans because it's going kaput.
Well, there's one thing interesting about the automobile business. Much like if you look at the housing business, when we've gone through a bubble of housing, people will curb back and they will not purchase for a while. They will rent for a while. They'll find another way for a while. Automobiles is almost a necessity in our lifestyle today, and they have a wear factor. After 4, 5, or 6 years, unless you really keep up with the maintenance and take care of them, you have to get another one. So even though we go through a down cycle in the auto business, and when you go back historically, you'll find there are periods where they've oversupplied and they go through a rough period. We have 300 million people plus living in this country. Half of them buy and drive a car. Sometimes they have two cars. They will come back and they will buy cars. Now, will they buy all foreign cars? Because the interest seems to be over there where the quality is now. The American cars are coming back on their quality. I think there's going to be an ebb and flow. We're going to flow back to the American car, and we'll see General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler back on their legs again.
Would you see them opening plants that are closing?
No, they won't open plants in this country. The health care issue and the cost of labor per hour is way too high.
Okay, well, we're getting down to the last few minutes here, so why don't we talk about, first of all, contact information for you and what it is that you have to offer in the way of enlightenment. I think you have a few books you're offering.
I have a few books I sent you an email towards that if people wanted to purchase. They were books that I've been distributing for years. And one is Gas Crisis Answers, which is a very interesting book. It's a composite of indexing periodicals. When you go to the library, you can find a lot of the periodicals that were written on these technologies, the fuel vapor technologies, the turbine cars from Chrysler, the hybrid cars that were developed over time. If you wanted to find a lot of proof, this is an index book of how to find all of that proof.
Interesting. And that's about $10 plus $2.50 shipping?
Right.
Okay. What's another one?
The other one is Larry Wagner's The Elusive High Mileage Carburetor. Now, this is a fellow that I met personally, had numerous conversations with in the during the early 80s when I had built one of these high mileage systems, much like a Pogue carburetor. He built one as well. In this particular book is his efforts. He had been an aircraft mechanic, and he had gone through the price rise, went through, opened the hood, started to change some things, built a vapor carburetor, and he shows how he built his size, shapes, and forms, photographs of how what he did. And he produced a car that got approximately, it was a 455 cubic inch Buick engine, 1974 Buick LeSabre, if I remember things correctly, and he produced almost 80 miles per gallon out of that vehicle.
Wow. So he could drive from coast to coast on about 30 gallons of fuel.
Well, now again, that all gets back to another issue we hadn't discussed, fuel chemistry and composition. Gasoline is not gasoline today as it was of the years past. They keep changing the composition so that many times you can do some of these vapor carburetors and they work. Many times, depending on where you're buying the fuel, that chemistry is made up of such compounds that will not allow this to take place.
So again, are we dabbling in conspiracy theories, or is this something that's provable that they've actually deliberately manipulated the content of the gasoline to prevent the implementation of these technologies?
Well, it's interesting if we go back in history where there were commercials for Shell oil that they had in the late 60s and early 70s where it was the Shell oil mileage tests. And they were constantly showing, expanding the envelope where they could produce 200 some odd miles per gallon, 300 plus miles of the gallon, and that these were challenge and tests showing that how far could we go with the gallon. Well, there's no discussion about that anymore.
Yeah, apparently their public relations people must have told them that this was good for them to do this.
Back then.
Yeah.
Today, we don't want to discuss how the fuel's made and how do we get efficiency out of it.
Isn't that interesting? This is the time when those kind of ads would really fly.
They would really fly today. When we were
paying
35 cents a gallon, we didn't care. At $3 a gallon, we care.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? What a contrast. And here it is, people, you know, sitting in their homes doing a webcast talking about these technologies, and they're silent on it, you know?
Absolutely. And they're making the work under the hood more complex than ever. When you open the hood today, the average person is so confused as to what they see, they have made it purposefully that complex so that they drive any maintenance to the dealer, and that's how the dealer now maintains their revenue stream.
And so you really have to try to beat them at their own game by coming up with a technology that can screw into a spark plug hole or something that can just bypass all of their high-tech garbage and turn that engine that they've designed to be inefficient into something that will still work with an alternate fuel, such as water.
Sure. And you have to bypass their electronic control unit, their brain box.
Yeah.
Their brain box has, much like we put virus, antivirus guards and spam protection for our computers, all these different layers, their electronic control unit called the ECU unit has layers and layers of the same program so that if you try to bypass it, it automatically interprets that and goes back to the original program to be a rich, wasteful burn.
Yeah, isn't that terrible? Again, there's that word evil that comes up. When I think of the word evil, I think of any technology that deliberately pollutes this planet and while making someone else richer. Someone who's already filthy rich, more money than they need for their lifetime, their children's, their grandchildren's, and yet they still want more.
Well, much like I sent you the email with a little bit of math on this more convenient or inconvenient truths or more lies. I did that quick math on that email, and it was stated at about $66 a barrel. We were up over $2 billion a day a week of waste that's going by here that we could have curbed back because if we used the more efficient technologies.
And that's just burning fossil fuel. We're not even talking about using water as fuel and so on.
We're not talking about using water. We're not talking about diesel. We're not talking about all the other fuels for the airplanes. We're not talking about lubricants or all the other plastics that could be, applications could be more efficient.
Yeah.
This is about maintaining a consumption curve for the status quo.
A consumption curve that is literally, before our eyes, destroying the healthy atmosphere, biosphere of this planet.
Well, when you look at the relationship at the turn of the century, the amount of people who had cancer and what we have today, we're approaching somewhere between 60 to 65% of the population will end up with cancer in their lifetime, whereas in the end of the 1800s, early 1900s, it was, I don't know, 1, 2, 3 out of 100.
So you feel that there's a correlation between
our
consumption of fossil fuels, the waste products in the atmosphere, and
when we make gasoline, it's made up of a composite, and it has so many different attachments of the toxic chemicals that the oil companies are supposed to be paying fees for to get rid of. They're attaching it to the hydrocarbon chains in the gasoline, and the automobile is the disposition device to get rid of it.
So imagine a car going down the road, and instead of it polluting the atmosphere, it was actually acting as a vacuum cleaner, cleaning up the atmosphere. That is conceivable, isn't it?
Oh, it is conceivable. In fact, Volvo has some technology they tried to bring forward 4, 5, 6 years ago where they actually had the radiator was made up of a chemistry, so as the air would flow through it, it was cleaning the environment.
Yeah, and of course using the hydrogen-oxygen fuel from water would have the same effect because it would burn the pollutants out of the air as it went through the engine.
Sure.
Well, we've come to the end of our time. Why don't we mention your email address so that people can order these books from you?
It's a bdennis433@aol.com.
Okay, the letter B, and then the name
boy,
Dennis.
D as in dog, E-N-N-I-S, 433@aol.com.
Okay, and in that way they can order copies of the three books. Now, I think we mentioned the first two. Did we not mention the third?
No, we haven't mentioned the third. And the third book was The Secret of the 100-mile-per-gallon Automobile. Now, that one's interesting from the standpoint of it has a quite extensive little story and history of the Edison of the vapor carburetor, Charles Nelson Pogue. Gets into the analysis of why the fuels are burned incorrectly and some storyline about Mr. Pogue and what he went through to try and drive that agenda of that high-mileage carburetor. It also shows in the back of the book, there's a photo in there of one of his production carburetors, which was a diluted version that they brought to the marketplace after the oil industry started to change the chemistry of the fuel.
Interesting. Now, again, these can be ordered for $10 each plus $2.50 postage. And I'm going to go ahead and post some of the contact information for this on the Blog Talk Radio website for this show. Okay?
Very good.
And it's been very nice talking to you. We'll have to do this again because there's a lot of ground we didn't cover. Perhaps we can get together next week, huh?
Then we can get back together for another discussion, and we'll talk. Maybe we can spend a little time about Stan Myers, because I've met his brother, Steve Myers, personally, and I've been to some of where the engineering was kept on Stan Myers' water fuel system.
Yeah, that sounds great. We'll look forward to it. And thanks to everyone for joining us.
Thank you.
Good evening.
Good evening. Bye.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.